Good morning.
There's a story about three religious leaders that were taking a trip together. There was a Jewish rabbi, there was a Hindu guru, and there was a TV evangelist. Well, their car broke down on a lonely country back road. It was just about dark. So they walked up to a farmhouse, knocked on the door. Farmer answered, and they said, "Yes, our car has broken down. Can you give us some assistance?" Well, the farmer said, "There's nothing around these parts here now. We'll be open till morning. You're certainly all welcome to stay here. The only problem is I only have two bedrooms, and that means that one of you is going to go need to sleep in the barn." Well, rather hesitantly, the rabbi offered up, and the rabbi said, "Oh, I don't mind. It's only one night, 8 hours. I'll go to the barn. The rest of you stay here." So the rabbi goes out to the barn. They all go to bed. A minute later, there's a knock on the door, and it was the rabbi. And the rabbi said, "I'm sorry, but there's a pig in the barn." And the pig is an unclean animal in our Jewish tradition. We have our dietary laws, and it would be unthinkable for me to share the same space with a pig. Well, the Hindu offered up next, and the Hindu said, "Oh, you know, guys, it's really okay. I'll go to the barn. You stay here." So the Hindu goes out to the barn. They all go to bed. A minute later, there was a knock on the door, and it was the Hindu. And the Hindu said, "Oh, I'm sorry, but there is a cow in the barn." And a cow is considered a sacred animal in our Eastern tradition. It would be sinful for me to share the same space with a cow. Well, finally, the TV evangelist shrugged his shoulders and he said, "Well, there's no other choice now. I guess it's up to me. I'll go to the barn. The rest of you stay here." So the TV evangelist goes out to the barn. They all go to bed. A minute later, there's a knock on the door. It was the cow and the pig. Oh, gosh. First of all, I want to say thank you for inviting me to speak here this morning. And I just want to tell you a little bit about myself and about our denomination. I am ordained in a denomination called Metropolitan Community Church. We were founded in Los Angeles in 1968 as a special outreach ministry to the gay, lesbian, bisexual community, though certainly not exclusively, but that is our primary focus. We have about 300 churches, about 50,000 members now in 17 countries. And MCC has stood really at the vanguard of human rights movement for the last 38 years, not only gay lesbian rights, but also human rights, all human rights in general. My denomination was one of the first denominations to begin ordaining women, and today more than half of our clergy are female. I really didn't know very much at all about Unitarian Universalism until I pastored my first church in Miami, Florida. That was beginning in 1987. 18 years ago, things were not nearly as open as they are right now. And back then, the UU churches really, aside from maybe the Quakers on occasion or the United Church of Christ, the UU churches were many times the only religious body that would allow an openly gay group to meet on its premises. And we shared space with the UU congregation of Miami for almost the entire 9 years that I pastored that church. And I'm very, very grateful for the experience, you know, for all the lifelong friendships that developed out of that relationship, that experience. I call today's message, "I'm Mad as Hell, and I'm Not Going to Take It Anymore." And the title was borrowed from a movie starring William Holden. The movie was called Network. It's old now. It's about 20 years old, so I guess I'm dating myself. But the story was about a newscaster named Howard Beale, who was obviously about to have a psychotic breakdown. And he got on the evening news one night. He stood before the camera, and he said to Americans, "I want you to get up from your chair. I want you to go to your window. I want you to open it and yell, 'I'm mad. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.'" So what I want to talk about today in the next 18 or 20 minutes or so, I want to talk about anger. And I want to talk about how, you know, contrary to the way that it is often portrayed as something very, very destructive, anger can be a very, very positive, powerful catalyst for great social change. I was raised as a Roman Catholic, and I went to Catholic school for 12 years. I'm still in recovery from that experience, even as I speak to you this morning. And the good sisters taught us that anger was evil, and that to express anger openly toward anybody was a sin. Well, you know, they were sincere, I know that. They were really speaking from their heart, you know, what they thought to be the truth. But dealing with anger is a very, very difficult thing, as we all know. Aristotle, the great philosopher, Aristotle said, to become angry, that is easy. Anybody can become angry. But to become angry at the right person and to the right degree and in the right way and for the right reason and to express it properly, that is not within everyone's purview, and it is not easy, and it isn't. You know, the fact is that most of the most profound changes in the human condition often happen because somebody got mad as hell and decided to do something about it. English prisons were a picture of vile filth until John Howard and his friends got mad and started writing about it. If you look at the writings of some of the abolitionists, people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, or some of the founders of the women's rights movements, Katie Stanton, Sojourner Truth, and those wonderful women, they have a definite angry tone about some of their writings. Florence Nightingale, who improved the quality of medical care for all time to come, she was not the gentle angel of mercy as she is commonly portrayed. She was a fiery, tempestuous woman who bullied and harassed government officials until they trembled at the very mention of her name. You know, in our own day, in contemporary America, anger has often been a catalyst for great social change. Have you all seen that TV program, America's Most Wanted, or at least you heard of it, America's Most Wanted? Well, if you know anything about John Walsh, who hosts that program, John Walsh lost his young son, Adam. Adam Walsh was abducted from a Sears department store in Hollywood, Florida. I think it was 1972 or 73, I can't remember the exact date, but I lived in Hollywood, Florida, and I lived about a mile from that Sears store when that event took place. And John Walsh's son was found murdered. He was found dead about 9 days later. Well, of course, John Walsh and his wife were devastated, as any human parents would be. And they were angry. They were angry at the police for their slow response and the way they believed that the police had mismanaged the case. But they took that anger and they did something wonderful with it. John Walsh has devoted the rest of his life to the cause of missing and exploited children. And hundreds of children have been saved because of what John Walsh has done. A young mother lost her most precious gift. Her young daughter was killed, lost to a drunk driver. Well, of course, she was devastated. But she joined together with a whole group of parents who had lost children to drunk drivers. And collectively, they formed an organization called MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And they have successfully campaigned for stricter DUI laws all over this country. One woman managed to change the consciousness of a whole society regarding the problem of drinking under the influence of alcohol. I asked our pulpit host this morning to read that selection from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The letter was written from a Birmingham jail after Dr. King had been arrested for leading demonstrations in that city. And Dr. King's letter is written in response to a letter that he received from the clergy association of that city. They called Dr. King's actions, quote, unwise and untimely. Well, Dr. King wrote that angry letter, you know, chastising the contemporary church for its complacency. And Dr. King also tells another story of of an incident that happened to him when he was a young man. He was 11 years old, and he was on a church outing with some of his fellow students, and they were on a bus about 90 miles north of Atlanta, coming back to Atlanta that night, and a group of white passengers got on the bus, and the bus driver said to young Martin, "Get out of your seat, nigger." And Martin said that it was the angriest that he had ever been in his entire life. But it was that very incident, it was that anger that in part helped to fuel Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s great prophetic mission. I said at the beginning that I am a liberal Christian. Now, please don't get nervous, okay? I'm not going to try to convert anybody, and I hope you'll indulge me if I use the J word a couple of times here. L. Scott Peck, one of my favorite writers, Peck says that the picture that we often get of Jesus, the popular picture that we get of Jesus of Nazareth, you see these pictures of Jesus, and he's always sitting on a green hillside, and there's clouds in the background, you know, and he's got a halo around his head, and there's this reverent gaze on his face, and there's lambs and little children, you know, gathered down at his feet. Peck calls that image of Jesus the wimpy Jesus. But if you look at the Gospels, you know, whatever your view of them if you just look at them as history or commentary, that is not at all the Jesus of the four Gospels. The Jesus of the Gospels was often an angry Jesus. He was extremely confrontational at times. One of my favorite gospel stories is where Jesus went into the temple and he got very, very angry about the way it had been turned into a commercial enterprise. And he was absolutely livid about the way that he believed that the poor were being exploited by the religious establishment. And he ran in there, he overturned the tables of the money changers, and he said, "This is supposed to be a place of prayer, and you have turned it into a den of robbers." Hardly politically correct, huh? Peck also tells a story. He said that one night he was in a strange city. He was supposed to give a lecture the following night, and a woman managed to get a hold of him somehow. She called his hotel room, and she said, "Is this the Scott Peck that is giving the lecture at the Civic Center tomorrow night?" And he said, "Yes, it is." And this woman said, "Well, my husband tells me he's too old to have sex with me, and I want you to tell him that he isn't." Well, Peck said that, you know, he tried to be loving to the woman. He said, "Well, you know, that's not really the subject of the lecture, but maybe I can talk to you afterwards, and maybe we can get you some peer support or something, you know," and he got off the phone. Well, Peck said, after the interaction, he said he realized how Jesus of Nazareth would have dealt with the situation. And he said what Jesus of Nazareth would have done, Jesus would have said to the woman, "Hey, lady, you've got a lot of nerve calling me in my hotel room, telling me what you think I'm supposed to speak about the next night. And furthermore, if you weren't so cranky and self-centered, maybe your husband would have more interest in you. Now, good night." At which point he would have hung up the phone. I that's all speculation, of course. I don't know what. I have no idea what would have happened there, of course. I don't. But I do know that people of justice and people who seek peace ought to be mad as hell. They ought to be outraged at some of the things that are going on today. One of my least favorite television religious personalities will remain nameless, except to say that his first name is Pat. And he has a club. You know, during the Atlantic hurricane season, remember how they had all those hurricanes in Florida last year? During the hurricane season last year, Pat said that he said several years ago there was a hurricane that was heading up toward Virginia, where his conglomerate is located. But he said he prayed and he steered the storm out into the open ocean. I mean, can you imagine the absolute arrogance of anyone making that kind of a statement? During the waning days of the debate on the Equal Rights Amendment in the mid-1980s, Pat said, this is a quote, this is what he actually said. He said, the Equal Rights Amendment will destroy the family. It will cause women to leave their husbands, kill their babies, practice witchcraft, destroy capitalism, and become lesbians. That's what he said. I mean, this... it would almost be funny if it was not so frightening. You know, I, as a person of faith, I am outraged at the way that right-wing religious extremist fundamentalists have hijacked my faith. When I was in undergraduate school, I was basically an agnostic then. But I took a course my freshman year in the sociology of religion, it was called. And the professor was a Jewish rabbi, Rabbi Jacobs. He was the local temple, but he taught a couple of courses. And I had an appointment with Rabbi Jacobs one day. It was in September, and I got to his office, and he said he was working on his High Holy Day sermon. And a couple of minutes into our meeting, he had to get up and excuse himself for a few minutes. And I picked up his manuscript. He was working on his, and I picked it up off his desk, and I started reading it. And he had made some notations to himself in the, you know, in the column. And in red pen, he wrote, argument weak, raise voice. Well, but you know, but that is what some of the religious wrong are so good at. I don't believe that these people speak for a majority of people of faith. They speak for actually a very small minority. They just happen to have the loudest voices. That's all. You know, what has happened now in this debate about values, you know, the great values discussion, is conservatives have tried to take the whole values question, and they have reduced it to two hot-button issues, abortion and gay marriage. And while those two things are important, and while we as people who seek justice, we can have different opinions about those things, abortion and gay marriage are two tiny parts of the whole values discussion. Truth-telling is a value. Truth-telling is something we have to consider in any values debate. A war that was started on a pile of lies for no other reason than to gain control over another nation's natural resources, a war in which, as of yesterday, 1,547 of our precious kids have been killed, 9,000 wounded, and 100,000 Iraqi civilians killed, is a moral question. Pursuing an economic policy of no defense contractor left behind, while 40 million Americans have no health insurance, while millions have no access to any kind of care, that is a moral value. That is a moral question. It just makes me so angry. And of course, abortion and gay marriage, they are very, very important issues. But you know, the great Hebrew prophets, Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they did not say one single word about sex. You know, the Christian church is not only homophobic, it's sexphobic in general. It has been all the way since Augustine in the 5th century. The great Hebrew prophets did not say a single word about sex. What they talked about time and time again throughout their writings was social and economic justice, and the way that the divine, whatever you conceive of the divine to be, they talked about the way that the divine always stands on the side of the poor and the marginalized against the powers that would oppress them. I work as a background actor a couple of days a week to supplement my speaking income, and one of the perks of being a background actor, you know, the pay is it's pretty pathetic. But one of the things that makes it kind of fun is that they always give us a gourmet meal. Always, you know, on the set, you always get a good gourmet meal. Sometimes two or three, you know, depending upon how long the day goes. And it always makes me angry when I see the amount of waste in this community. You know, when I was working on my master's, I had to do 150 hours in a community service agency, and I chose food banking. That's where I developed my interest in, you know, in the hunger problem and feeding the hungry. And the other day when we were on the shoot, I saw someone throw a whole chafing dish heaping with prime rib and another full of baked chicken into the dumpster. And we were working at the Los Angeles Athletic Club, which is in kind of a, you know, it's kind of a marginal neighborhood, and there were homeless people on the street and in the alleys. And I said to the crew, well, why can't we just give this to the homeless? And they said, no, we can't do it because of the liability issue. You know, you can give, if we give the food out, you know, if somebody could get sick and we could get sued. Folks, there's something seriously, seriously wrong there. I'm sorry. It is morally outrageous to throw 50 pounds of prime rib and roasted chicken into a dumpster when people 50 yards away do not have enough to eat. That is morally unacceptable. There is more accumulated wealth in the United States of America today than in all societies in human history since the beginning of time combined. And yet 1.3 million Americans, mostly children, slipped under the poverty line last year. That is morally outrageous. 65,000 people on the earth will starve to death today or die of preventable diseases, not because they have to, but because we allow them to. In the hour and a half that it will take us to conclude this worship service and our coffee hour this morning, more people in the world will starve to death than perished in the September 11th attacks, and yet there will be not one bit of press coverage and absolutely no public outcry. Folks, that is morally outrageous. I think we ought to have a constitutional amendment banning hunger, don't you? Thank the divine for all the women and men of the ages who got mad and used that anger to change the world. Thank God for John Howard and Katie Staton and Sojourner Truth and Susan B. Anthony. Thank God for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thank God for Rosa Parks, who hung on to her seat on the bus that day in Birmingham and afterwards could say with ungrammatical profundity, "My feet is tired, but my soul is rested." Thank God, thank the divine for all of them, people who got mad as hell and change our world. They have truly made a difference. May we all be just a little bit mad. Amen.